Okay, hello everyone. We got a good one for you today. Welcome. I appreciate your spending some Saturday with us. I'm Foster Gamble, and I'm here on the bridge of the Thrive Together virtual enterprise. Hold on just a second. I'm getting a message. My camera's not working. So there, I think we're on. Okay, so let me start again just to welcome everyone to a great Thrive Together gathering today. I'm Foster Gamble, and I'm here on the bridge of the Thrive Together virtual enterprise with Kimberly, Goa, Rob, and Mitch, along with subscribers from all over the world, and today's special guest, Nassim Haramein. This is a great treat for me to have him on, and just to get, I don't get a chance to talk to Nassim as much as I used to, and to be able to share it with all of you is a real privilege. So we're going to launch in just a moment, but first let me turn it over to Goa briefly to make sure you have your seat backs and tray tables in the full upright and locked position and that other logistical details are handled before we go. So Goa.
Thanks, Foster. We are recording this event and we're going to make these recordings available as archives to you and others. It's a reminder on that. Please register early for these events and enter the room early to avoid any technical problems. I saw a bunch of people sign up or be logging in early today, so thanks for that, too. Please leave us comments on the Thrive Together portal page about what topics you want us to cover, and please check that comments area before the event starts for anything interesting that Foster or others may have left. If you have any technical problems today, please email events@thrivemovement.com. Those emails go to Mitch, and please let him know when that email or when that technical problem gets resolved. If you're using a mobile device, polls are not going to be available for you today, and we apologize for that. Use chat for comments and to share resources with other people. When you're entering chat or resources in, please make sure that it's marked to send all participants. Let's quickly review the process for the Q&A today and how you'll be participating with video. Please use the Q&A section and that panel to enter your questions. And when Kimberly picks your question, she'll tell me your name and I will make you a panelist and I'll unmute you at that point. Please stay or go into full screen mode and you'll be reminded of that icon is a little three people, looks like a three amigos button. It may also be two arrows pointing in different directions. Either way, you might want to go to full screen mode now. And you'll notice there's a little green box at the top. Drop that down, click on participants. And then you'll see the list of participants and you should see your name in that list at that point. Click on the gray camera icon next to your name. That'll get your camera going and we'll be good to go. And please, you know, make sure your camera is connected in advance. Finally, please be succinct with your questions. 1 minute for questions or 2 minutes for your comments. We really want to involve lots of people today, so please be succinct. And finally, at the end of the event, when the evaluation pops up, please fill that out. We do love your feedback, and we use it to improve the experience for you and others. So, Foster, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Goa. And one more thing before we get going. A lot of folks in our network have been very excited about having Nassim on here. But before we get going, I'd like Rob to bring up one short poll that everybody can respond to, unless you're on a mobile device. But basically the purpose of this poll is just to get a sense of how familiar you are with Nassim Haramein's work. So if you see the poll there in front of you, just click one of these. I am not at all familiar with Nassim's work, a little familiar, or quite a lot. So if you just click one of those and then hit submit down in the lower right, that'll give us a sense of who's on the call in terms of your familiarity, and that'll help us kind of shape the depth of different aspects of the conversation. Okay, it says the poll has ended, so we should be getting results quickly on that. Okay, so of the people who are able to respond, 11% not at all. Well, welcome. You're in for a treat. 29% a little. and 32%, quite a bit. The other 29% are on mobile devices, so we don't know with them, but this is usually a characteristic ratio. So thanks for that. That will be helpful. Okay. Before bringing Nassim on, I want to just tell you a little bit of background on him, especially for those of you who are new. Nassim and I have been friends and colleagues since the late 90s. Among other works, he's the author of the Holofractographic Universe Theory. Amongst his papers are one called Scale Unification, a universal scaling law for organized matter that, in my mind, changed physics forever, simplified the whole universe in a nutshell. Another one called Quantum Gravity and the Holographic Mass that is creating waves around the world right now. And he's also the author of a patent called Device and Method for Simulation of Magnetohydrodynamics. So we'll get into all of that a little bit. It's not going to be a super technical call, I don't think, today. You know, you can go much deeper on his website, which we'll talk about and give you links to. With his work and with our work, you can go into plenty of depth. But this is, a rare opportunity to kind of go behind the scenes with Nassim and in terms of our relationship and some of the struggles and successes that we've had over the years and hopefully some things that you can learn in your own quest from what we've been going through. You know, I've had the opportunity to work with hundreds of scientists over the last 40 years. And frankly, Nassim is the most advanced of them all in terms of his understanding of what's called cosmology, which is just a fancy word for figuring out how the whole universe works. Nassim is a bold explorer. He's an ingenious inventor. He's a courageous advocate for the freedom and the awakening of every being and for peace and love throughout the cosmos. I would call Nassim a global citizen, at least. He is a French-Canadian American, born to a warm and vibrant and nurturing Italian mother and a brilliant analytical Iranian educator, who was a protege of the famous child development specialist Jean Piaget. I've had the opportunity several occasions to spend time with them, and it's a treat. Nassim is more accurately, I would say, a galactic citizen. With, I figure, at least 64 PhDs from the University of Cosmic Relations, starting with ET visitations at age 7, and daily travels ever since then through meditation into what he calls hyperspace, as well as other destination resorts as a student of Maharaji. Nassim is what some call an autodidact, meaning he claimed the politically incorrect path of rejecting state propaganda institutions as early as high school and went on to create his own education. Many people don't know he was a world-class skier and mountaineer, working at Whistler Mountain in British Columbia, where he would earn enough money in the winter to then hop in his van in the spring and go to various universities, libraries, visit with various mentors, gather materials, and then head off into the desert for months of study and meditation. He's deeply knowledgeable, as many of you know, about ancient cultures, about geometry, about energy and physics, as well as many other areas. And I personally believe much of Nassim's breakthrough understandings from my being around him for many years were nurtured by his feel for aligning with energy through skiing, rock climbing, motorcycle riding, surfing, and other activities. You know, I'm a skier also, and he and I have talked about this a lot. When you're skiing, when you transfer from a left turn to a right turn, you have to unweight, and you have to find that zero point where you can shift your skis and then come down and apply pressure, you know, through gravity into the hillside for your other, for your next turn. And that I have watched his understanding, his physical understanding of the aligning with energy. I've watched it inform his theoretical and technical work with invention in really exciting and I think little recognized way. Nassim declared back in the early 90s that each galaxy must be centered by a black hole. and of course received consistent ridicule, much of which I got to witness, unfortunately. Thousands, NASA monitoring of the 40 closest galaxies finally revealed that they were all indeed centered by massive black holes. That was only one of more than 20 predictions, which I've kept track of, that I watched Nassim make, which have either come true already or are looking more and more likely. So we're going to do some time travel with this wizard today. We're going to be looking back. We're going to be catching up on the current status of his projects and how that interfaces with some of ours. And as well, we're going to be looking into the future. But before we strap on our seatbelts, let me just welcome you, Nassim, to the Thrive Network and to this think tank event. And congratulations, I'm happy to be able to say this publicly, on the remarkable success and spread of your work around the world. Now, I know you've been especially busy the last 2 days, so how are you and what have you been doing these last couple of days?
Thank you, Foster. So great to be with you guys again. And thank you for having me on, and I love your t-shirt.
This is the Connected Universe t-shirt.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's been a busy last few days. We've been having meetings with some of the most advanced inventors and thinkers in the various groups that I'm involved with that work in laboratories around the U.S. and Europe. And, you know, it's been 2 days of presentations of some of the most extraordinary information you can come across, and you know, mind-blowing stuff and discoveries as we went, as the synergy of the information between all of us kind of built over the last 2 days. So it's been so amazing and critical for this time specifically. There's a lot of various thresholds that we're approaching, and some of the amazing thinkers and as well some of the people in the financial worlds and corporate worlds are kind of coming online remarkably. People that would be today thought to be very much in the mainstreams are coming online. So
fantastic. Well, maybe we'll get a chance to touch into some of that today. You know, what we've done is plan to structure today's conversation in three segments, just for everybody's information. We're going to, Nassim and I are going to be reminiscing a little bit, looking back at the early days. And then we're going to be talking about the current status of some of the projects, as I mentioned. And then we'll break there for some Q&A time. You know, this is not a radio program. It's a think tank. And we really want to give Nassim plenty of time today, but we also want to get your questions. We've been collecting some of them online. Some people have written in, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. And then after some Q&A time, then we're going to come back and spend some time looking forward. We've asked Nassim, and I will join in as well, to predict a little bit. What are we going to be seeing over the next 50 years in various different realms? And then we'll have some more Q&A before we close the conversation. Okay, so starting looking back, let me just describe really quickly, because one of the things that people have been writing in is they want to know, you know, when we met, how we met, what we connected over, you know, how this all got going. So let me just announce to the group briefly that when I was preparing with another team for the first Sequoia Symposium in 1997, it was only about a week or two before the conference was going to start, when I get a call from a near-death survivor, Lynn Claire Dennett, and who was one of the sponsors and one of the presenters at this Sequoia Symposium. And she says, I've just met the most amazing guy, and you two absolutely have to meet. You not only have to meet, but you got to get him at the conference. So I said, well, you know, I'm really busy. It's just a few days away. She said, listen, he's talking in San Francisco tomorrow night. Trust me, you have to be there. So I was. I got in the car and went up to San Francisco the next night, and Nassim started talking, and the hair went up on the back of my neck, and I realized, oh my gosh, I have been looking for this for a long time. And I was sitting with a guy who was convinced that Nassim was not only crazy, but probably going to destroy the world by creating a black hole that was going to suck us all in and everything. And meanwhile, I'm going like, oh, finally, this guy's answering these questions that I've had that no one else has been able to answer. So I went up to Nassim at the end of the talk and thanked him. And I then asked him one of the questions that I had been wondering about for a long time. And he had an immediate, simple, and clear answer. And I thought, okay, I got to work with this guy. And actually, that was the beginning of our working together for about 5 or 6 years. But first, it was the beginning of my inviting Nassim to the Sequoia Symposium a few days later. And that was kind of our first experience together of facing the challenges that it takes to bring in new paradigms that challenge the old ones. You know, as I talk to people, I get the impression that in both your case and mine, people look at the success that we've had, and in your case, they know you're brilliant and you're funny, you're a great storyteller, and many think that it must have come easily to you. And I know that wasn't true. So I invite you just to talk a little bit about the challenges of being decades ahead of the curve, and especially if you want, as it might have related to our experience together at the Sequoia Symposium.
Yes. Oh my God. Well, you know, yeah, behind the scene is a whole different story, and that it was such an amazing thing to get to meet you that fateful night when I presented at 3220 in San Francisco, which for me was the end of a line. I had been in my van almost full time for almost 5 years at that time. And I had been very dedicated to studying intensely all the work that I could find on physics, ancient civilization, symbolism, everything I could find. I had piles and piles of stuff in my van, and I was just studying as much as I could. And at the same time, I was surviving on very little, and I had run out completely of resources. And I was on my way back to Canada with the last few pennies I had, just enough to put gas in my tank. And in fact, you know, kind of ran out around San Francisco, and through connections with friends, got this miracle of being able to organize a quick talk in this hub of incredible thinkers that was 3220 at the time, and I was able to and for me this was like a lifesaver, because it was gonna give me the money to pay for gas to go all the way back to Canada and go and work. And talking about the challenge of bringing this information forward, I mean, for me, it started very early when I was a child, and I would start thinking about these things and talking about these things. And I quickly realized that it wasn't the common thoughts and the common views, and that people were not necessarily reacting in a way that was supportive or interest, but there was a lot of concern that maybe I wasn't put all together and so on, especially at school. And so it got me in a lot of trouble at school. I was very isolated and lonely for much of my childhood. It was very painful as well. Later on in the ski industry, as you mentioned, I was a skier from very early on, and for me it was a way to liberate myself, especially from the difficulties I was having at school. And so as soon as I could legally quit school, I did, and I went skiing because I knew that brought me joy and to be in nature. And so I was teaching skiing, I was teaching climbing later on, and ice climbing and all this stuff. and mountaineering, and I was in the mountains with all these different guides and colleagues in the ski industry. And in the ski industry as well, they're again attempting to talk about all these ideas I had about the universe and the way flowers bloom and the way, you know, snow crystals form and all this was not received very, very well. And so I learned to not talk about that stuff. I learned to moderate what I could say or not say, just so that people didn't feel confronted in many cases. And even when I was in the van, you know, I had very little contact with the public outside. I was mostly soloist, so I would solo climb, you know, up scaling mountains in the morning at sunrise and at sunset in the afternoon, and then the rest of the time I was pretty well clustered in my van. But the few times I would come out and sit around the fire with other climbers and campers, I sometimes would start talking about the things I was researching, and in some cases I received fairly violent feedback. And so it led me to that fateful moment when we met and you invited me to the Sequoia Symposium. And I remember thinking, wow, I just made this money. I can like run to Canada and make some more so that I can survive, or I can take this chance. I can go to this talk and see where it leads me. And, you know, of course, I wasn't going to skip on that. And I could feel your heart and I could feel your knowledge base was so tremendous, so amazing, so aligned to what I had found. You know, I knew I had found a brother from a different mother, and it was an amazing time.
Well, let me pick up on that for a minute and fast forward to the Sequoia Symposium, where first of all, Nassim was so adorably willing and dedicated to trying to share his information with a very eclectic group of scientists, but a lot of traditional ones from Georgia Tech and MIT and Stanford Linear Accelerator and so forth. And he went out and got a jacket and a tie. And he starts making this presentation and laying out the ancient cultures and the geometry, and now all of a sudden how it's leading to free energy and tying into extraterrestrials and so forth. And so I was the MC of this conference, and so I start getting notes getting passed to me, and literally the notes for the most part are saying, okay, how can we stop this guy from speaking? This guy is insane. We've got to get him off of the platform right now. And one of the people writing was a famous mathematician, and another one was a co-sponsor of the conference. And I wrote back to the co-sponsor a little note saying, I'm sorry to hear you're uncomfortable with what he's saying, but I suggest if it gets to be too much for you, you simply get up and leave. Well, nobody got up and left, but it definitely started rattling the paradigms of the people in the room. And Nassim was allowed to finish his talk, which was fantastic. And then later that evening, I gave mine, and I had not anticipated. I mean, Nassim was used to taking this flack by that time. I had not experienced it yet. So I followed up on what he was doing, talking about the vector equilibrium and the torus and time travel and all this kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, people are standing up and being very polite and saying, you know, you really need to shut up. And somebody even suggested that, you know, to me, thank you for taking the time and doing your research and so forth, but we recommend that we just all stand up and get in a circle and have a group hug and move on to the next event. And I was furious and also just kind of in shock. And I said, no, you know, this is an event where we're each here to hear what one another has to say. So I finished, and I tell you, it was practically chaos in that place. And to his credit, the mathematician who had wanted both of us to stop the night before came to me the next morning as we were about to start. I didn't know who would show up and who wouldn't the next day. And he said, I was up all night. He said, I realized I was scared to death. And finally, in the middle of the night, I got it. He said, you and Nassim are on a very rational basis, stretching our paradigms. And we are holding on with our fingernails to what we used to believe to be true. And I just looked at him and I said, thank you for your courage and your honesty. You know, would you be willing to share that with the group? Which he did. And that opened up. That was the initial conference, and we met several times a year for close to 3 years and really did a lot of breakthrough work. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on Sequoia before we move along?
Well, I thought, you know, it was when you give your talk, I felt my heart sink because, you know, at least they hadn't interrupted me. But they went after you pretty hard. And I remember trying to find a way to soften the crowd and so on. And, you know, I was just getting you and me in more trouble every time I opened my mouth. And I remember coming out of that first Sequoia symposium, I was tearing up. I was deeply in pain. I was hurt, and it wasn't so much the personal hurt, because some of the participants were actually the next day pretty rude to me, but it was the sense that, oh my God, how long is it gonna take?
Right.
You know, it's been so long already for me at the time that I felt, you know, so much rejection of those ideas, not just me as a person. But I was just thinking, can the earth hold on?
Yeah.
How long it's going to take for people to actually open up to this possibility that we live in a medium of information and geometry that we can tap in to and change our world with.
I remember you sharing the story with me after we met that first night, that when you had come out of the desert, just previous to that, that you had actually sat by yourself next to the fire, contemplating whether to try to take this information to the world or not, because you really had an intuitive sense of how difficult it would be, and you know people have been burned at the stake for this kind of paradigm shifting before. And I was so touched by hearing your story that you were sitting there meditating on, you know, just listening for the guidance of, should I take this pile of papers that you had next to you and throw it in the fire and just go try and have an easy life, a normal life, or were you going to actually, you know, claim what you knew and try to share it with the world? So for everyone, I want to express my gratitude that you made that decision.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. Go ahead.
Another story that comes to my mind with some of the people from the Sequoia Symposium is that there was one physicist in his 80s, one of the most famous physicists in the world. I'm not going to name him just because I don't want to get into any squabbles or demean his reputation at all, because these stories simply represent the dynamic that's out there with traditional academia. And anyway, he shared very openly with us at the conference that he knew he didn't have that much longer to live, and he was dedicated to completing Einstein's work. And as we listened to him, you know, absolutely brilliant guy, wonderful research, and the piece that he was missing, I really felt was what Nassim and I were trying to bring, especially in terms of looking for the fundamental pattern that is universal to all scales, as opposed to looking for some fundamental physical building block out of which everything else was made. And so I actually invited Nassim to join me going back east to the university where he was a tenured professor to spend a few days with him and a few others trying to convey this idea. And, you know, I thought this was a real offering. So we did. We went back there and we spent 3 days in intensive conversation. And on the last day, it was getting frustrating for pretty much everyone, I think, even though a lot of important stuff had happened. And at one point, he looked to this senior physicist, looked to his key protege and said, you know, help me out here. Can't you tell these guys that they're way off track? And his protege looked at him, who's also gone on to become a famous physicist and mathematician. He looked at him and he said, you know, I hate to say this, but I have to tell you that I think Nassim is on the right track here. And I think we really need to pay attention to this and integrate it into what we're doing. At which point things started getting thrown around the room. Literally the recorder that I was recording all of these sessions with went flying across the conference room table into the wall. And, anyway, it was a real education for me.
I'll always remember that look on your face when I saw the physicist reach out for the tape recorder and you knew what was going to happen and you were horrified because the tape in there had so much important information. But yes.
And I want to tell another story along that same line because I think it's a really, it was an important one for me. And it has been for a lot of people that I've told the story to, and I think can be for a lot of the pioneers who are on this call. And this has to do with, we did a presentation one time for some potential donors to what became the Resonance Project. And one of them, it was actually at the house of a self-made billionaire who's super intuitive. And he totally got what we were presenting. And he came up afterwards and he said, this is absolutely amazing. I'm going to give you guys whatever you need to fund this. And so then as the days and weeks went on, he said, okay, well, we just got to run it through past my money guys and the accountants and all this kind of stuff. So he brought his science guy, who was also his money guy. I think the guy had a bachelor's or master's in biology or something like that. And he was supposed to come in and be the gatekeeper for this, not well, really for the money. And he didn't get what Nassim was talking about at all. And so kind of arguments went back and forth. We finally ended up in a meeting where Nassim laid it out once again. About these holographic fractal patterns and how it's the fundamental pattern of the universe and all this. And I could see the guy getting very afraid. And he finally stops Nassim and he turns to his billionaire boss and he says, do you realize what's going to happen to us if we actually let in what he's saying? And I'm like, what's he talking about? And the billionaire looked at me and said, no, I don't. What would happen? And he honestly said, we would cease to exist. And I was stunned, but I realized this guy is serious. And when it comes to paradigm shifts, it's not just a matter of the money. It's not just a matter of the control or the reputation or the tenure or the revenue or whatever. It can be fundamentally, if you identify with your worldview as yourself, and if someone comes along and challenges the basis of that worldview, it can feel like you're going to die. And I think that's why a lot of people, a lot of innovators have suffered in the past when people in power were challenged in this way and then became very dangerous.
And this is something I got to give you credit for. It's something that you taught me to have compassion for and to have patience with. Because as you know, at the time, you know, I was not very patient with these type of reaction. I would react back and so on. And, you know, it would just escalate. And specifically at one of those symposium, Sequoia Symposium, that was just after we spent time in that institution on the East Coast where things went flying. I learned very, you know, important lesson about having the empathy for somebody that has spent his whole life thinking a certain way and relating to the world a certain way, relating to themselves a certain way, and then somebody coming and disrupting that, and how difficult that can be, and how much resistance they naturally would be to changing those feelings and opinions.
Yeah. Well, I want to kind of close that little segment by sharing one other story to show what can happen if you hang in there. Because after Thrive came out, I got a call from one of the most famous astrophysicists on the planet, the head of the astrophysics department at another famous East Coast establishment. And he called me and he said, "I've seen your movie. I just want to thank you and congratulate you." He said, "If I could have made one film in my life, this would have been it." And I thanked him for that. And I said, "You know, frankly, I'm in shock that you're telling me this with your very traditional background and position and so forth." I said, "What made you open to this?" And he said, "Well, you know, kind of on the sly, I've been really looking into the energy thing. And you're right on that. I've been looking to the time travel thing. I think you're right on that. And even the ancient cultures and the extraterrestrial thing and so forth." And so we had this wonderful discussion. And I said to him at the end, I said, "You know, I highly recommend that you get together with Nassim, because I think you can really learn a lot from each other about cosmology and astrophysics and so forth." And he just flipped back into his old persona. And he said, "I don't have anything to learn from Nassim. He doesn't even have a PhD. So I said, "Okay, well, if you're convinced you don't have anything to learn from him, then I'm sure you're not ready to learn anything from him." So that was actually the end of the conversation. And to his credit, a few months later, he called up Nassim and invited him to come to this famous East Coast establishment, where he actually collected a dozen of his colleagues and spent a day with Nassim. At which point Nassim blew all of their minds. He was invited to stay a second day, and now they are working colleagues.
Yes, that was amazing. And it tells you how, you know, things are changing. Actually changing. People are opening up, and, you know, I just went to the Royal Society in England. It's probably one of the oldest physics establishment in the world. And certainly, you know, one that can be thought as very conservative. Some of my work was very well received. And people, actually, the conversations that were going on were remarkable at breakfast and lunch and suppers. And, you know, I think it's, you can see the change. You can see it happening. It's remarkable. It's exciting to see.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. I mean, you won't hear it that much from too much of the mainstream media yet, but the evidence is in, studies have been done, and the fringe is now the mainstream, especially thanks to the internet. Okay, I want to move on to the next chapter that we had together, which was when we created a secret energy lab in the Santa Cruz area back in the early 2000s. So this was something we didn't talk a whole lot about, what was going on there. I want to mention a couple of the highlights for me of that experience. The first of which was that Nassim started building his long talked about resonator. And one of the predictions he made was when he got the first torus done, because of course it was going to be a double torus device. He said when he got the first hemisphere done, he said, "You'll see, it will invite its dual, its partner in, and we'll be able to sense with our equipment an invisible second torus that will come and join it." And I'm like, "Yeah, right." So you finish the first half and call me to come over to the lab and hook this thing up and started running a little bit of electricity through it. Yeah, I started some rotation going. And then sure enough, you took a magnet and some other device, I don't remember, and showed me that the same field that we could measure around this torus that was sitting on the top of a table was also measurable, a second torus invisible underneath the table. That definitely got my attention. And then when he actually had finished the device, at least the first iteration of the device, he made another prediction to me, which was, he said, we'll probably get help from the extraterrestrials in tuning this device, because it was a resonant frequency device. And again, I'm like, yeah, right. Let me know when that happens. And sure enough, he calls me up a little while later and tells me it happened and we've got video. So could you describe a little bit what I'm talking about?
That was such an amazing time. It was so exciting for me actually to be able to actualize some of the, you know, engineering that I had been thinking about for so many years prior. And, you know, working in laboratory, I started to get more and more inspiration as I built, of course. And, you know, and the fact, I mean, I was hoping for that ghost, the old tourist, to show up, but the fact that it showed up was, you know, surprising me as much as you. But I was excited to see it, and then that one night, where what had happened is we had put the device together in a room not far from mine. And we had not put power to it, meaning there was no equipment connected to it. There was nothing going on. And we didn't expect anything to happen, of course. We had put power to the device earlier, but it had been weeks, literally, since it had been powered. We hadn't expected that the device was actually in training the structure of space-time at a level that it could stay coherent, which is what the only explanation that makes any sense for what happened next, which was that I woke up with a very distinct low hum in the house that seemed to emanate from the room where the device was. And that was startling, as like, what is humming over there? The room was literally completely empty of any devices or anything that could be, you know, there was no cell phone in there vibrating or anything. There was just a hum coming out of the room, and I was blown away. So I got out of my bed. It was like something like 3 a.m. and I was putting my, you know, pajamas on or whatever I could find to like kind of dress up a little bit. And as I looked out the window, there was a white light in the middle of the bushes that was really bright, like a little sun in the middle of the trees there across my room. And I was like, we lived on, I think this was like a 10-acre property or something. There was no neighbors there. We were on the top of a hill. There was nothing there that could be shining a light in the woods. And that light looked very different than a spotlight or a flashlight or anything like that. It was extremely bright and it was very, very spherical. And it had like this radiating energy aura around it. And so I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is some strange event. Maybe I should grab my camera and start filming. And so I grabbed my camera, which was right beside my bed, and I turned it on and I started to film. And I was not really realizing the camera was had an infrared sensor on it and multiple things that were, I believe, disturbing the energy, because this ball of light was kind of hovering, kind of aligned with the device that was across the hallway from my room, and that was humming. And I got the link that as I had said, you know, something was trying to help tune the device. But at the same time, I was getting messages that I shouldn't be filming. But I was obstinate because I was like, I gotta have record of this.
Otherwise Foster's gonna go, yeah, right.
Exactly, because I was like, nobody's gonna believe me. So I kept on filming and you can see in the video, until I something happened and my legs just went out from under me. And I fell to the ground with the camera and I couldn't use my legs anymore. So then I decided to crawl out of the house, literally on my elbows, to try to get some more footage. And by the time I got to the corner of the house on the outside, the phenomenon had moved around, and then there was other spherical objects flying around, and I pretty well gave up on trying to film. And so it was an amazing event.
Now many people know the notion of these glowing orbs. I know, yeah. James Gilliland's got many hours of footage of orbs. They're being seen all over the world, but usually photographed with cameras, still cameras or video cameras, and some clairvoyants can see them without a camera. That's how James has been seeing them for years, but he'd tell people, you know, point your camera over there, and then it would show up. So that, we won't go down that tangent right now, but just to complete on some of my memories of that particular lab. And by the way, Nassim, you know, is known a lot as a theoretician and a geometer and so forth, but this guy is a serious inventor. He had an engine in his garage running on water at that time, and ultimately decided not to pursue that because there were, you know, a major automobile companies who were putting billions of dollars into similar technology, and he wanted to work more on the resonator. But when this first iteration of the resonator started taking on a life of its own, you know, if you could bring up one or both of the pictures that I sent to you, the images of the kind of ribs of the resonator, that'd help people to get a sense of what we're talking about here. And while he's doing that, I'll say that when we put small amounts of electricity and started the magnetic field rotating and then unplugged it and found that the field was sustaining itself, that's when we got the guidance to create a sanctuary for this thing, take it out of the lab and give it a room of its own and then start testing the effects. And we did a number of experiments where we would put, there we go. That's the kind of double torus. You can see behind us him there, as well as the graphic that we got a still of over on the left. That's the double torus. But if you could bring the black and white ones up, if you, I don't know.
That's a picture of me when I was much older.
Actually, you know, I think you don't have the black and white ones. I may bring it up on mine later on. Why don't you take all those away except the double torus? Well, okay, that's fine. So when we moved the resonator into this other room, we started doing experiments with water, where we take tap water, where we'd take filtered water, and where we'd take what we called resonated water, which is water that had been in a clean glass container in with the resonator for at least a day, just kind of soaking up the field. And the results were phenomenal in terms of the growth of plants, and in terms of the sustainability of cut flowers or blossoms, went to two or three times as long with the water that had been exposed to the resonator, which is, again, a prediction that Nassim had had given that, you know, because I used to ask him, well, when you get the resonator done, what's the first thing you're going to do with it? And he said, well, you know, my guides have told me you put it, go out and put it in the middle of organic vegetable field and it will enhance. And I'm like, oh, I like that. You know, that's a good place to start. But anyway, so we had a bunch of successful experiments going on there. Once the resonator started going, and Nassim had found that it would go into resonance at certain octave frequencies, many of which were in the radio frequency domain, which he anticipated might cause concern to the powers that be. And sure enough, you know, within a very short amount of time, we started seeing repetitive black helicopters circling, and then the classic, closed panel van down at the bottom of the driveway at the bottom of the telephone pole. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Funny, because these guys were in, I can't remember the name of the phone company over there at the time, but were in one of those vans. With a massive, satellite dish deployed on top. And they were there day in and day out for literally weeks, working on Saturdays and Sundays at one point for like at least a two-week period. And I remember going by there and offering them coffee one day, because I figure if these guys must be hating it down there at the bottom of the hill by themselves. And, it was an amazing time. And at the same time, it was a time of, concern of our security and our capacity to do this in a safe way. I remember thinking, if this, is this the time? Is this the right moment? Are we in a place that the Earth is ready for this type of power, this type of technology? Because it had incredible effects on biology, positive effect on biology, but as well, it opened the gates, behind the veil, and all sorts of phenomena that, in some cases, were challenging for me to even me to interact with. So, in some ways, I was, content that we actually kind of folded and moved on and, continued the journey.
Yeah, ultimately that's when Nassim decided to close down that lab and move to a more secure one offshore. So the last thing I want to talk about from that phase is that I just find the synchronicity to be very touching for me, that I'm now living in SoCal, California, within walking distance of the house where I used to come down and visit you a couple times a week from where I lived in Silicon Valley. And we'd hang out in the basement of this house where you were renting. We were brainstorming the future. You know, how do we bring this information out? Are people ready? You know, who might be open to it? What would be the most effective means? And I remember specifically, I've still got my notebooks from when we were brainstorming a possible film. And then we had so much material for the film that we thought, well, maybe this ought to actually be two films. And, years later, that became Black Hole and Thrive. So do you want to talk a little bit about those days when you were kind of imagining how to use the media to get the word out, particularly on your theoretical work?
Yeah, it was so great to see your passion light up when we would start talking about film. It was something you were deeply passionate about. And And I was too, in terms of, I need to get this information out, and how can we get it out the most effective way? Because I knew I couldn't ask people to study for 15 years, you know, geometry and all, and physics and all this stuff. And somehow we had to, like, get people the gist of it, get people not only excited about it, but have, you know, people actually understand some of the main principles that have such a huge impact on people's lives every day if they understand them. And so we were dreaming up how we were going to do this. And those were awesome sessions. I'll always remember them because it was literally, you know, such a great visualization, because we would order our thoughts on how we would, how the film would convey the ideas and all this. And it helped me a lot in being able to present all this in a more succinct way, and in a way that it would be easier understood for the public at large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question before we wrap up on the kind of looking backward. Is there anything that you would like to share in terms of what you've learned from your struggles and your successes in bringing new information out into the world? What advice would you have for others who are involved in similar activities?
Well, I think what I've learned, I've learned many things, and many of these things I've learned as a result of our companionship, and you know, and that is that, first of all, you know, when you find this stuff, there's this, and you get it. Yeah. There's this thing that goes on inside of you that starts laughing, you know, and being in joy and being excited and looking for, and I get it and I can feel it's right and all this. And typically you want to convey that, of course, to your best friend, to your family, to, you know, your spouse, your kids and so on. And, it really is typically not easily received. And so what I've learned is to be able to moderate my internal dialogue when I'm conveying the information, so that I can see where I can go with a person, and I give them just enough to stretch their thoughts in very subjective way, suggestive way, I mean, meaning that, like, I don't impose ideas, but I offer, you know, different perspectives that, you know, the information, you know, that problems could be resolved with. And you know, that that I really genuinely listen to their opinion, to their rebuttal, to, you know, whatever is coming up for them.
Wow.
So that it's a real conversation. It's not me trying to impose something. It's a real dialogue in which there's truly an intent on both sides to learn, you know. And so that's one thing that I learned.
Let me just say that is such profound advice. People out there, please let that in. You know, Kimberly has been my ongoing coach, and that we all need coaches in this. And Kimberly continues to help me to this day. It makes all the difference. You know, she keeps reminding me it's not about presentation. It's about communication. And that means that the other person actually needs to want to hear it. And yes, it needs to be an exchange that goes around toroidally.
Right, exactly. And and you know, I by maturing this way, I've actually learned a lot from people that have different opinions. And you know, there's always, if you look for the good, there's always something good. And There's always something to learn. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I learned is that my biggest challenge in my life, the biggest lesson for me in this life is patience. And to know your biggest challenge is to at least make the first step in resolving them, in transcending them. And I wouldn't claim anywhere close to having transcend that one yet, but I'm working on it. Yeah. And I know that it's there. So when I feel that anxiety come up, and when I feel that like frustration and anger come up, I'm getting better and better at remembering that, like, the key is patience, to breathe through it, that no matter how angry or frustrated I get, it will be, you know, best if I keep breathing and stay calm.
That is valuable and hard-won advice. Thank you very, very much. Okay, let's move on to in our time travel up to the current day. And I would appreciate it. I know you've got a lot going on. I know you've recently just moved from Hawaii to back to the mainland. I follow along in a lot of the activities of the Resonance Academy, but I know you've got something I think called Taurus Tech or Taurion or something like that. And I know some of the stuff you can talk about and some of it you can't, but could you bring us up to date briefly on the Resonance Academy and on whatever technical developments you've got going on that you can talk about?
We've done a great transition at the Resonance Project in the last few months. It was time for us to reintegrate onto the mainland for various reasons. One of them is accessibility and our capacity to continue to do our work and move forward. There was as well a great need for the foundation to transcend and transform its structure so that the theoretical work that we were doing could continue moving forward, but some of the practical application work could move forward at a better pace if it was transferred to a different organization. So that happened. And that was really successful. It happened very quickly. And we've done, you know, a lot of work in the last 3 months to, like, set up all these different organizations and to establish laboratory space as well. So that's really exciting. In fact, in the next week, we will be actually fully set up and functional. And some of the result of that is that we're going to be able to have a much more focused attention at the Resonance Project on the public outreach, on all the programs that we have out there and the academy and so on, and, you know, parallel to it, in a different organization, there'll be a very, very strong focus to application and development. So that feels really good to me. It's good to bring the two into their highest mode of operation so that the focus can be very strong and very productive on both sides, and not be a little bit muck up together and interfering with each other.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so thrilled also that you've had the time to lay the theoretical groundwork for the technology that you're developing and also so many other technologies that are coming out now, because it makes it not only more believable when it comes out, but it also makes it so that more and more people can be doing their own type of inventing. So you've built a bridge between classical physics and the new physics, which is really unmatched in what I've seen. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Along that line, let's talk for just a moment. I'm going to give you a major challenge here, which is to I want you to address two of the meaning of the paper. Let's start with the the paper that I was around when you were writing the paper on the scaling law. And what I'd like you to do is see if you can do a non-scientific abstract. In other words, like two or three sentences, let people know what for you was the importance that you were conveying in that paper. What's the key message of that paper?
The key message of that paper was that the universe is organized. It's not random, free for all. Everything is just flying apart and it started in a big bang and, you know, there's no organization. And the fact that we're here is just a miracle that came, you know, as a result of some mathematical, statistical fluctuations. And it was just an accidental event, but that actually our universe is highly organized, and the scaling law demonstrated that, because all of a sudden if you plotted the energy of systems relative to their radius, they landed on a graph in a very organized manner, all the way from the Planck size, which is a very, very billions of times smaller than an atom size, all the way to galaxies and quasars and the size of the universe even. And all the data point lined up very nicely. And the relationship between the data point had phi ratios involved. And then when you plotted, you know, the microtubules, which is the cytoskeleton of the cells that makes up the biological structures. When you plotted that on that scale, it ended up being bisecting the graph right in the middle. So that biology was like the link between the very large and the very small. That was the purpose of that paper. In terms of the philosophy that I was trying to convey from the paper, of course, it had deeper purpose in terms of the physics, showing that energy is not only quantized at the quantum level, but that it's quantized at all level, all the way through the scale throughout the universe, where you know, kind of galaxies, energy levels and radiuses are in one specific section, stars are in another, atoms are in another, like layers stack on each other.
By the way, Goa, I just sent you a picture of the graph that Nassim is talking about. If you can retrieve that and bring it up while he's talking, that'll, I think, help people.
Yeah. So that was the main impetus of that paper. As well as another one that was really, because it leads into the next question you're going to ask me.
Exactly.
Was that when you did this graph, there was something puzzling about it. And that is that the Planck size, that little Planck dot that's billions of times smaller than an atom, was definitely, you know, it obeys the condition of a black hole, and so does the universe. The universe itself obeys the condition of a black hole. It's actually, if you calculate the mass, the universe is about 10 to the 55 grams in a radius bubble of about 10 to the 28 centimeters. That is a perfect condition for a black hole if you solve Einstein's equation for gravitation. And so then the plots that on the plot, the stuff we were putting in between were like considered black holes, like quasars, galactic centers, and all this stuff. But the atom fell onto this graph, and the atom is not thought to be a black hole.
By most people.
Yes, that's right. And that definitely was, you know, I on purpose added that data point on that plot so that I could, hint at something for the papers that I was preparing to come right after.
So most people are now on your screen will be looking at the graph that I was talking about. It's low resolution, but you can still get a sense of how all those circles fit on a smooth graph. And those, basically those This is representing how the different scales tie in together through the fundamental pattern. In other words, whether it's an atom or the sun or the galaxy or the universe, we're actually looking at the same pattern, just at different scales. Is that an accurate representation, Nassim?
Yeah, exactly. We're looking at same energy to size ratio relationship at different scales. So my point was there must be some fundamental geometric parameter that makes that so, you know, that makes it so that your universe will organize only in these specific quantities across scale from the quantum size to the universal size. So it was a very remarkable thing that it came out. And when I was working on this paper with Dr. Rauscher, it's important to mention that Rauscher was my co-author in there, and she was blown away herself as we plotted the data points on the graph that it lined up so good.
Yeah, I remember you several people from the Sequoia Symposium were trying to persuade me to get Nassim to go back to school and get a graduate PhD in physics. And I said, first of all, that's not going to happen. Secondly, it would probably destroy him and his theory and his ability to theorize in the process. So I decided instead I would look for an open-minded physicist who already had traditional knowledge and all the math skills. And Elizabeth Rauscher was the one that I found. And so the three of us holed up in a hotel here in Soquel and just downloaded information to her for several days. And then once she grasped it enough, she said, okay, well, I'd like to help you. What can I do? Nassim says, well, I'd like you to calculate the sun as a possible black hole. And her jaw just dropped. She is a black hole physicist, and the thought had never occurred to her. And she said, no, that couldn't be because, you know, it would be this particular size because of the mass and so forth. And Nassim said, no, you got to consider the black hole at the center and that the corona is the event horizon at the outside, at which point her jaw drops again. And she said, okay, well, I'll do the math. Well, about 2 weeks later, she calls back just totally in shock and excitement and says, it's an exact match. And Nassim said, okay, good. Now, you know, now do it for a galaxy. Now do it for the universe itself. And it all played out. So it was really profound for me just to be around the verification of that notion.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it's still very hard to convince mainstream scientists to consider it because the tendency is to say, well, if I run the black hole equation for the sun, the sun would have to be an 18-kilometer diameter, I believe. And, you know, it just, and it's just not that. So, of course, the sun is not a black hole. Now, I just want to say for the audience, if the sun all of a sudden was a black hole, or if it is, it would have the same mass. So planets would be in the same position, would orbit in the same place, and we just wouldn't all get sucked into the black hole, which is an erroneous notion about black holes. But what is not being considered is that a certain portion of the material inside the star can be a black hole that makes up some of the mass of the sun, and the rest of the material is orbiting around that mass, you know, in what we call the orbosphere of a black hole. And that's what we observe from the outside. We just see the white stuff, the radiation coming out. Although in the radiation, there's holes where the stuff is going in, we call sunspot. And in there, we see it's black. we see the electromagnetic field being absorbed, but it hasn't become the popular notion yet.
And if you want to see a graphic of this, remember to go back to one of the Nassim sections where he and I are flying on the Navigator in Thrive, and we did an animation of that. In fact, Goa, who's hosting the technical aspects of our call today, was the one who did that animation.
Mm-hmm. That was awesome.
Okay, so I think you were getting warmed up to move on to the next paper, which is called Quantum Gravity and the Holographic Mass. Could you summarize that in a couple of sentences and then tell us, so what? What are the implications if both of these papers are true?
Well, actually, the holographic mass paper was a continuation of an earlier paper called the Schwarzschild proton that got me in a lot of hot water. It was after the scaling law, I started to think, okay, well, you know, how do we characterize an atom as a black hole? And, you know, when I thought of the atom, of course, I thought, well, if there's a black hole in here, it must be the nuclei, must be the center part, just like the center of the galaxy is a black hole and so on. And as I thought that the center of the sun may be a black hole. And so I started to calculate for the proton, for the nuclei of an atom, why it wasn't thought to be a black hole. Because these things act a lot like one. You know, they're undifferentiable, meaning they're all the same. And they have this crazy characteristic that they don't go anywhere. They don't stop at any time. They don't chill out. They don't have entropy. They do not decay. Protons have never been seen to decay. A combination of protons in a nuclei can decay, but the protons themselves don't decay. You can snap them together. You can do all kinds of stuff to them. And they've been spinning and doing their thing for like at least 13.7 billion years. You know, those are energetic characteristic that you would think would be associated with very high energy levels, very high, angular momentum and so on. And that would be consistent with being, mini teeny little black holes. And so I right away, saw that, of course, the mass of the proton as measured today is not adequate to make it a black hole for that radius. But then I considered all the stuff that is typically ignored, and that is the energy that's present in the space. So in quantum theory, space is not empty. Space is full of fluctuations of energy. We call the Planck field or the Planck fluctuation or the vacuum fluctuation. It has many, many different names. Zero point energy is one of them, for instance, because it's thought that even at zero Kelvin, that field still oscillates where, you would think it would stop. And this energy density at the vacuum level is very, very high. And people might think, just for the listeners, people might think, how can there be all this energy in the space? The space is empty. It's obvious. Look, there's nothing here, but you consider that, like, in the space you're sitting in right now or standing in, there's electromagnetic waves, there's radio waves, there's all kinds of stuff. There's microwave that are going to your cell phone. There's all sorts of stuff going on. You're not necessarily directly aware of it. Well, this field of energy is occurring at such a granular size, billions of times smaller than an atom. Of course, you're not experiencing it directly. Although, according to my finding, that actually your direct experience might be what you call your consciousness. But
that's another topic.
That's another topic. But so I calculated how much of these vacuum fluctuation, which can be thought as little bits of information, are present inside a proton. And when I did that, something crazy and remarkable happened. That is that the amount of information in terms of Planck fluctuation that was inside the volume of a teeny proton, which is 10 to the minus 39 centimeter cube, it's like super small volume, was the exact mass of the rest of all the protons in the universe. So it was the mass of the universe present holographically inside one proton. And I was like, oh my God, of course, if the universe is holographic, that would be necessary. If the universe, it was just such a confirmation, a mathematical confirmation of the connectivity, the fact that the whole thing is one big connected universe. And then I calculated from there how much of that mass would be necessary for the proton to be a black hole. And I realized that when I did that, any black hole that came around that other little proton black hole would be attracted with a force exactly, and it was not approximately, it was exactly equivalent to the strong force, or the force we think is holding the protons together in the nuclei of an atom. And that was a huge confirmation, because all of a sudden I could account for the strong force, which has just been thrown in physics. There's no source for it. All of a sudden I could account for it with gravity, saying actually it's just because the protons are mini black holes that they stick together so strongly in the nuclei of an atom. So that led to the holographic mass solution, because I had to explain, this is why I got in so much hot water, because I published that first paper, and you know, I hadn't finished the solution, meaning the first paper just was pointing out that if you consider the proton as a black hole, it gives the right answer for the strong force. Then I had to explain how come we only measure a very small portion, 10 to the minus 24 grams, of the mass of the universe that's supposedly inside that proton, right? And I had to explain that. It was, it was a big task. And I could see it in my head. You know how we, you know, you and I, we think in geometry and we visualize things, and I could see it in my head for 5 years. I could see it in my head. I just had to find an equation that said that all the other protons in the universe influencing one was producing that mass for that one proton, but it was connected to all the rest of them.
Wow.
And I couldn't imagine what you know, like how to solve that equation. Literally 5 years of very little sleep, trying, like hours and hours of writing physics and trying all sorts of combination and trying all sorts of approach. And then when I found it, oh my God, it was so simple, Foster. I couldn't believe how simple it was and how it was right under my nose all this time for like 25 years. We had talked about it so many times, you and I, and all this. And it just is like, how could I have missed that? Because I had gone so far away from geometry. And then all of a sudden, it came out. It was a simple ratio of the amount of information on the surface of the event horizon of the proton relative to the information inside. And I first did it for a cosmological black hole to see if it would work with a black hole we knew in the universe. And it worked perfectly. It gave me the exact mass of that. If I calculated how much little Planck's there was on the surface relative to the little Planck's that were on the inside. Because I thought about it, I thought, oh, maybe the information is not able to come out because it's restricted by the amount on that it can express on the surface. It gave me the exact mass for the black hole. And then I applied it to a proton, and it gave me the exact mass, exact, for the proton.
Which was then verified after you published the paper, right?
That's
by,
right.
By a whole different study.
Exactly. Well, from the paper, I was able to, because when it gave me the first mass for the proton, it was off by 4%. But I was already ecstatic because I was hoping, remember, I'm using numbers that involves the mass of the universe. And I'm trying to nail the mass of one proton, which is 10 to the minus 24. So I was thinking, like, if I even get within one order of magnitude, I'll be just, oh my God, right? But getting into 4% of the value, I was so excited. But I thought, wait a minute, my solution for cosmological black holes is exact. So why is it wrong by 4% for the proton? And then I realized that the radius of the proton was not so well documented. We had a hard time measuring it. So I actually reversed the equation so it would output a radius, and I predicted what the true radius of the proton should be exactly according to my equation. And I didn't know, and when I published, I thought maybe it's going to happen in my lifetime, but it could be that this measurement is never verified in the laboratory because it's so difficult to measure the radius of the proton. But unbeknown to me, there was an experiment ongoing that was going on in an accelerator in Switzerland where they published like 3 months later or a month and a half later after I sent my paper to Library of Congress that measured the proton radius more precisely than ever before. And it was 4% smaller than the expected value by the main, the standard model. And my prediction was not only very, very close within 0.00036 of the value from the experiment, but I'm inside the margin of error of the experiment. So my value might be exact and the experiment is getting close to it.
Okay, so especially for the lay people, what's the implications of this for the rest of us? How can you apply this? What difference does all this make?
Well, let's forget about physics, but the difference it makes for each one of us, well, first of all, philosophically, it's saying, okay, so you're made out of 100 trillion cells, which is already like an insane number, to like visualize, oh my God, 100 trillion cells. It's an amazing thing. And then each cell is made out of 100 trillion atoms, So now it's astronomical, the little things that makes you up. And then in each one of these atoms are protons, and each one of them has holographically imprinted and in time, meaning that, instantaneously updated all the time. It's not like Microsoft, you gotta wait, for the next update. It's like happening in real time. And it, on all the information in the universe present in each one of those dots that makes your existence. And that all this information is highly coordinated, highly organized so that you're completely coherent. The miracle that you are is an incredible thing. For people to realize that is critical to, like, they're not some kind of error of nature that, like, kind of anomaly that, like, just happened. But that actually you're part of this incredible miracle of, incredible information structure of the universe, and you're participating. You're talking to the universe every billionth of a second, every Planck second of your existence. You're actually informing the universe of your point of view and your interpretation of your environment.
And does this have implications also for traveling through space and time?
Oh, absolutely. And, interestingly, since my paper came out, other papers from some of the most famous physicists in the world have come out talking about a very specific change in physics that is actually very important. It's called EPR equals ER. And it has to do with the fact that they're realizing that, in quantum theory, particles can be entangled, where two particles can be away from each other, even across the universe. And if you change one, the other one changes instantaneously. Well, that's been known in quantum physics for a very long time and proven in laboratory. We can entangle particles. At this point, they can entangle even diamonds, so large objects. But what is remarkable is that now they're realizing that this entanglement might be the result of little wormholes, Planck-sized wormholes that are connecting the particles together and all the black holes in the universe together. Mm. And so, and this is not being written by me. This is being written by very, very well-respected physicists. And so this kind of completes the picture, because that means that indeed, we, if we actually were to log on to this universal net, and here I'm just going to moderate it by saying there's ways to log on with your being, with your consciousness, but there's a technological way you could log on as well. You would be able to transfer information across the universe instantaneously. And all of a sudden, space travel takes a whole new dimension, literally.
All right. Well, that's a conversation I look forward to pursuing in the future. And I think that's a good note on which to open this up to the rest of the group. I could go on all day, but I want to bring some other people in here. And what I'd love to do is, I see that Marshall Lefferts is on. Marshall, if you're willing to come on, I'd love for you to get your camera ready. But first, I'd like to start actually with Goa. Because Go and I were talking about this event yesterday, and he had several questions for you, and one of them had to do with intuition and your work, and what you just said cues into that. So Go, you're on already. So if you could go ahead and ask that question, and then while he's answering, get Marshall ready.
Sure. Thank you, Foster. Nassim, I'm curious, how does your meditation intuition play into your research, and more specifically, what do you do in particular to actually connect with that sort of unseen realm?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. I think for me at this point, it has a lot to do with, first of all, every day taking the time, even if it's not a formal meditation, even if I don't sit like a pretzel in my bed or whatever, to actually connect with my center, to connect with the center of my existence, to like go within a little bit and get, you know, a feel for my connection to the rest of the universe through my singularity. And it's a referential thing, so that throughout my day, if I get out of center, I have that reference that I can go back to, and it's not been months since I've been there. I know where that center is, right? And so then I can get back to it. That's one thing. But as well, I think being in nature, being in, you know, with animals, with trees, with waves, with, you know, being out there in the natural world inspires me. It turns me on. It, like, I see the pattern, I see the geometry, I see, so that inspires me a lot, and that's where a lot of the intuitions come from as well. And this constant, you know, to be honest as well, it's this constant back and forth between being very analytical and intellectual and completely letting go and just opening my heart and feeling, you know, and the two working together is kind of critical to actually inform my thought process.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. And is Marshall ready?
Yeah. Go ahead, Marshall.
Hey.
Okay, great. There he is. So let me just briefly say to other people that Marshall is a longtime dear friend of Kimberly's and mine and Nassim's, who has worked intimately with Thrive for almost a decade, as well as with the Resonance Project. So he has first of all, a lot of patience and a lot of talents and skills, but also a very unusual perspective. And if you could just share any reflections you're having on this conversation, I would love it. And also, while you're doing that, I will put into general chat here the link to the cosmometry.net URL, which is the website Marshall is a brilliant geometer in his own right and has a fabulous and beautiful website that you got to visit. So, Marshall, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here. Thanks for inviting me into the conversation. I just want to you guys say a quick hi to my mom.
Hey there, Irene. Hello.
She and I are listening together. She's
wonderful.
Core of everything that we do.
Right.
So it's great to be able to share that with her and be here with you guys. And, you know, I became aware of all this early on in my life as well. For 20 years, I felt like I was kind of living in my own little made-up bubble that was hard to explain to other people. So it was when I actually met Nassim, I believe. Actually, I think I met both of you right around about the same time.
Yeah.
But when I heard Nassim, you know, do a talk, it was like, wow, here's the first person I've ever met who's actually saying that the same thing. You had really developed the physics and the model and the ancient cultures and everything. But in terms of the fundamental geometry, coming from the Buckminster Fuller School of Geometry that we all did, that was the first time I heard somebody that was really taking those ideas and expanding on it in a way that I knew in my heart was absolutely right, you know. So for ever since then, we've been collaborating together, and then I met Foster and worked on the Thrive film. So, you know, you guys are really two of my favorite people and pioneers in the world. So it's always a pleasure to hang out with you guys. Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Thanks for coming on, Marshall. And Kimberly, did you have some?
Yeah, I just wanted to say it's so interesting because as you described this and have this conversation, you know, the sense of calm and comfort and relief that really comes from the deep understanding and embodiment of this sense, you know, this complete organized enmeshed relationship where we can be distinct and unified and just, you know, never alone. We're just so connected and so impactful and so impacted, and yet, you know, our worldview is so much determined by science that people who had their worldview informed by a different science that was based on isolation and scarcity and all this kind of stuff, that the process of allowing this new scientific awareness in would give them so much more, you know, and I think that's part of the excitement for those of us who have this experience and want to share it. Like, oh, it's so much, it's such a warmer, better reality, you know, than you're experiencing. But it's nonetheless, you have to first have your world shake in order to have it come back together in this other way. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of true on all fronts, whatever the aspect of your worldview is. And one of the neatest things about this, for me, I know, was that it kind of helped me in the overall experience of world shaking, because in my research into the world in different arenas, you know, I was similarly misinformed. The scientific understanding that you brought resonated so much with me spiritually that wasn't a hard thing for me. But politically and in terms of certain things going on in the world, I had, you know, worldviews that really had to get rocked in order to understand what is going on, and then also ultimately relieved me, you know, to understand that we're so much better off than we know. We just need to claim that. And that seems to be kind of the answer at the end of all of these things, is that we are so connected and empowered, and that all we need to do is awaken to that. And then, like, I just heard this great quote from Ray Charles, who was talking to Jamie Foxx, and Jamie Foxx was getting prepared to play the part. And he says, you know, Jamie, all the notes are right under your fingers. You just need to take the time and care to find the right ones. And I thought, no, that's it. We have everything we need to be thriving, and you're contributing to the scientific informing our worldview. And of course, with Thrive, you know, we're taking all these different ways of relating to the world and trying to do the same thing. And I, I think the empathy is that it's a challenge to have any of our worlds shake whenever they do. And the good news is that it gets more and more comfortable. Like now, when I learn something new, it's familiar to be on shaky ground and allow not knowing for a little while, you know? Mm-hmm. And so anyway,
speaking of taking the time and care, I want to just interject that Kimberly played a key role while we were making Thrive. When Go and Marshall and I would go off for, you know, weeks or months and work on these computer graphics, communicating this geometry, then we'd present them to Kimberly, and very often she would look at them and she would look at us, you know, and she knew we were hoping it was all done. She said, "Well, guys, you know, it's really beautiful, but I don't get it yet." And it would take weeks or months more before we had actually unpacked it to where the person who doesn't get up in the morning thinking about dodecahedra could actually make sense of what it means and how you can apply it in your life. And that was a big part of the success of Thrive, was people like Kimberly unpacking it to where people can relate, not just as an esoteric practice, but as a core part of each human being. So thanks for that, Kimberly. Okay, I think we should go on to some more questions. Kimberly, do you have some lined up?
Yes, I do.
So our first question, the person can't, they're actually phoning in, so we can't make them a panelist. So is it okay if I just read the question?
Sure.
Great. So this is coming from Dennis Swanson. And they'd very much like to know about your thoughts about the Corey Good material that is being presented in Cosmic Disclosure interviews with David Wilcox. Are you familiar with that work?
I think lightly. I don't have enough information to be able to comment on this. I would have to study it some more. I'm unfamiliar. Can you give me a hint on more of what that whole information, maybe it'll bring it up in my mind.
Go, I know you've been looking into it, as have sure. I a little bit. Do you want to summarize? I mean, it's probably not the one to go deeply into now because it's massive, but just to, so that people know what Dennis is talking about, you want to give a quick summary?
Sure, 10-second summary. So Corey Good is a whistleblower who allegedly spent 20 years in the secret space program and then had his mind wiped and was time traveled back to when he left and then sort of had to recover all those lost memories. His time in the secret space program.
Right.
So there's a series on Gaia MTV now where David Wilcock interviews him for hours and hours. There's no hard physical evidence of what he's saying, but his story is, first of all, it's fascinating. It's like watching a Star Trek episode or something like that. But it's also amazingly coherent, not only internally coherent, but coherent with other whistleblowers from the secret space program. It's about the Sphere Alliance and the Blue Sphere Alliance and the Solar Warden program and various aspects of sometimes competing secret space programs, some of whom would rather take over the Earth and some of whom are protecting us from exactly that. So that's one that if we can explore at a future time.
Yeah, okay. It's a big one. We have lots of people calling in. And one thing I wanted to say for folks is that our next event, you know, where we just hang out casually like this, is on January 9th, and it's going to be Q&A with Foster, just any, you know, looking into some good news and looking into just forward into the new year. So any questions or things, whether from this call or anything else that we've ever done that you want to move forward with, we'll be doing that on January 9th at noon. So I just wanted to mention that. And also, we've got Becky and Melanie and Spiri and Sky and all kinds of people here with questions. So
why don't you bring Melanie up?
I think there's another order to this that's already in the queue.
Oh, okay. All right.
Sky actually was in the queue next.
Yeah.
Sky, are you there? Do you want to get your camera going?
Yeah, it should be.
That's okay. Just ask.
That's okay. I was wondering, since everything's traveling through these black holes instantaneously, does that mean that perhaps that's the origin of what some people call the Akashic Record. And does that also mean that when I learn something new, immediately everybody else does too, whether they're aware of it or not?
Great question.
Yeah, those are great questions. Absolutely. The Akashic Record, and actually this concept of Akashic Record, is present in many ancient civilizations. And I add to this field of information that holds all the information of all things at all time. And, you know, actually, in a paper I just presented with Dr. Brown and Dr. Val Baker in Lisbon a few months ago, which is not public yet, but it's a paper. It's my first paper that addresses consciousness from the physics perspective. You know, the title is involve a word I coined to actually make more precise the terminology space-time that was coined by Einstein, where Einstein put the two concepts of space and time together and mathematically, and then made one word called space-time. I modified it to space memory, because without memory, there is no time, right? If you couldn't remember the second before, you wouldn't have no time, and so there would be no evolution. And so basically, there is this set of information, which is memory on the structure of space, right? So and so you can imagine that when you learn something, you're modifying the structure of space, even physically, meaning we know your genes are changing, we know your DNA is changing, we know all sorts of things are happening, you're secreting all kinds of hormones, you're doing all kinds of stuff. And that stuff is actually interacting with that field of information, and it's leaving very specific information imprint on the structure of space as you travel through space on this incredible spaceship we call Earth. And so it does mean that this information becomes available, and that supports, for the first time, in a physical mean, because this, I'm talking philosophically, but this is physics, as I showed, these equations are very precise. It actually supports the idea that the morphogenetic field is present, meaning that, you know, the 100 monkey scenario where if you get enough people, they've noticed even with chemical reactions around the world that when it's done for the first time, it's really difficult to do it. But then more and more laboratories reproduce the chemical reaction, easier it gets and easier it gets to get it done. It's been shown as well that, like, you know, if a certain amount of people start thinking in a certain way, it all start all of a sudden becomes available and easy, and it starts to pop out all around the world. Historically, for instance, great discovery are commonly found across the world from each other, unrelated people that all of a sudden have the same idea in the same kind of moment, and all of a sudden it becomes available to the morphogenetic field all around the world. So yes, it becomes available. Does it mean that everybody gets it right away? No, because it has to have enough momentum. It has to be embedded enough by enough people for it to become more and more available, but it's definitely there. So yeah, everything you do, everything you think, every move you make is being recorded by this structure of space-time.
That's okay. Cool. So mass meditations work.
It does, and it's been empirically proven by the egg computers that are random generators around the world that shows very specific, non-random dynamics as soon as there is global meditations or global events, definitely showing that the field of information is being modified.
Yeah, and Maharishi University has done numerous studies when they have a significant number of meditators move into one community and begin meditating on a regular basis, the crime rate immediately starts to drop.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, we have so many questions here and a lively group, and I just wanted to encourage people to go to the Resonance Project, and we'll put the link for that also where you can continue to learn more about and from Nassim, and they have all kinds of stuff going on where you can tune in and be part of the real-time teachings and experiences. So
yeah, I just put that link into chat for the Resonance Project and also for the Connected Universe, which is Nassim's next film, I believe. Can you give us a quick update on the status of that film?
And we still have more questions, too. Two more to get.
Yeah, we also need to fit in our future predictions here.
Well, the status of the movie is that it's still in the editing bay, and it's my fault. It's been delayed because of me. I'm so sorry. You know, some of the earlier cuts just didn't cut it.
Oh, take your time.
Willing to put something out that I didn't feel completely. and so I sent it.
Don't put out a film until you feel 100% good about it, because you got to live with it for a long, long time. It's just we delayed the release of Thrive for so long until we felt, you know, just 100% there. So take your time.
And I saw on the website that the goal. The goal of the Indiegogo was 172% funded back in February or something. Do they still need money to finish it, or have you got all the money you need?
Yes, you know, filmmaking is a very expensive enterprise.
Your sound's cutting out for me.
You know, I think we should grab Melanie up here too. Next.
Okay, I'm not sure if people heard all of that. I'm not sure if I did, but make sure if you're interested, go to the Connected Universe website that I put in chat. Look at the trailer, which is absolutely stunning, and you'll get a sense of what this film is going to be. And if they still need help, you know, help them out if you can. Okay, go. Let's bring Melanie on.
Melanie, go ahead.
Okay, Can you see me? Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we can't see you yet.
How do I do that? Do I press on
the green camera?
Click on the camera button next to your name in the list.
Okay, my light just went on. Can you see me now? I'm one of those people that doesn't wake up in the morning talking or thinking about the dodecahedrons. And I know exactly what you're saying, Nassim, you know, that you can think of something in your mind, but you can't exactly, couldn't get it out. And I hear what you're saying, and it's exciting to listen to. It's very thrilling because I see that when I look at all the chaos in the world, I think it's exciting to see that we now really have proof that we are connected and what we are doing is really impacting others. My question to you were talking about the way you connect with the universe and how you, connect through consciousness activities and meditation. But you also mentioned technology as well. And I just wondered if there were technological things, ways that you're connecting through devices or tools or apps, I don't know, anything like that you could recommend that would help empower us even more.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You caught on to that, did you?
Yay!
I'm privileged that I have some of these. There's a little bit of feedback.
Noise.
That's funny.
Do you know where that's coming from?
I don't. I'm trying to find it. I don't see it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find it.
There's some sort of echo. Make sure everybody's got their speakers turned down low.
It's coming from Melanie. Go ahead.
Okay.
It was coming from Melanie, so I just
mute you while he's answering.
I just did.
Go ahead, did that.
Okay, great.
Okay. So what I was saying is that it's not working.
It's intermittent.
Oh.
Try again.
Let me try this. Is that better?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, so what I was saying is I'm a little bit privileged because I have some of these.
Trey Poindexter's name keeps coming up on the panel. I'm wondering if there's some interference there. Okay, try one more time, Nassim.
Okay, so I'm a little bit privileged because I have some of this stuff that I built in 99, as we were discussing earlier, that, you know, I'm actually in the midst, finally, for real this time, of bringing to the public. So, you know, stay tuned. I've got some really fun, amazing little gizmos for you guys to help connect with the field and the universe and yourself.
And when the Sim says little gizmo, it's a fasten your seatbelt moment.
Yes, I've been actually holding back on some of that stuff because of the impact being so important for some people. So, but I would recommend, there's a lot of interesting devices out there. If anything, I would recommend devices that give you some feedback about your heart-mind coherency. And so I would definitely recommend some of the device that HeartMath have put on the market, that are little monitors that you can carry with you. They're really easy to have around. And they actually tell you how well you're doing in getting into that coherent, mode where your heart coherency is, you know, at its optimal, and that you're actually being the most receptive and the most tuned in to the field. And I've tried these devices, and I know how it feels when I'm coherent and when I'm not. And they're very amazingly accurate. It's very interesting. So I think that's a really good device to start with. Some of the stuff I'm going to bring out is not only is more on the... is going to be a little bit more dynamic than this, in terms of it will not only give you a sense of your level of coherency, but it's going to tend to tune you to the field. It brings you into that coherency. It supports your energy field to actually get into that coherent mode in a very dramatic, positive way. That has a lot of health benefits as well. So, you know, I'm excited to be able to bring that out.
Yeah, that's something great to look forward to. And I would add to that, Melanie, for people to check out the Monroe Institute, the binaural technology. Mm-hmm. Also, if you have a neurofeedback, brainwave biofeedback training center anywhere near you, I was involved in that in Silicon Valley for 8 years. Super powerful, non-invasive technology. And also, Kimberly's been using an app that she's finding very helpful with meditation. What's the name of that app, Kimberly?
Well, I use lots. I think Calm is a great one because it's not the binaural sound, which I really like for my longer meditations, but Calm is just this free app that I've been giving to like my son and some other people who are moving really fast, but just the reminder to breathe stop and breathe and connect in, a lot like what you were saying, Nassim, about the reference point, just a daily reference point. And it doesn't, you know, I tend to meditate for, you know, maybe 45 minutes in the morning, but if you have 2 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever it is, anytime throughout the day, Calm is just a great way. It's just an app on your phone. You put in your earplugs and you just remember to breathe and tune in and be present. And I think that, like we were saying, it's a matter of waking up to who we are. So you don't really need anything other than that. To come back to center is what's required. So however you get to do that is the way to do it. And so I like Calm as an app, and I also love the Monroe Institute. And there are a lot of others now that are doing this binaural sound bead. I see Katarina Johnson. I just got a notice today. I haven't checked it out, but on her website, she has a new guided meditation with the binaural seat behind, and that's katarinajohnson.com, I think it is. Anyway, there's great stuff.
Okay, we're coming up to the end of our time, unfortunately. And we promised the people, Nassim, that both you and I would do a brief look forward. So what are the things that come to your mind as some of the things that you think will be happening, that we'll all have the opportunity to experience as long as we're here over the next 50 years? What are some things that you think will be in place?
Well,
in that interlude?
I think that, you know, and people may say, well, it's been a long time that that's up and coming. But I mean, if you think about it cosmologically, our evolution is very short. And certainly the last 50 years or the last 100 years of technical development is a very short period. But I know for a fact, and you do too, that over-unity technology is present on our planet. It's been developed by many inventors, and that it will become available. It will become available in the next few years, in the next 10 years, in the next decade. We are going to see this. And as this new technology that extracts energy directly from the structure of space-time comes in online, large changes in our affairs are gonna occur. It comes hand in hand that, for instance, when everybody can have a device in their house that runs their whole house and runs their car and all this stuff without having to put anything in it, comes about that the financial structure that is mostly based on oil and selling arms, the military industrial complex will collapse. And that there will be various disturbance from this, but eventually a recovery to a new civilization that is much more aligned with the fundamental principles of nature and with our environment as a whole, and that's sustainable. So I really believe this is going to happen in the next few decades, and it's well on its way. With it comes technology, which is much more close to my heart in what I do in laboratory, that has to do with our capacity to control gravitational field. This is critical for the planet as well. Everything we've done in the Industrial Revolution has been really to learn to control and utilize electromagnetic field. We learned what electromagnetic fields are. We learned how to control them with very much so the help of Nikola Tesla. And we basically birthed a whole, you know, advanced civilization based on this. The next step in our evolution is to learn to control gravitational field. And some of the equations I've written gives us the clue and the engineering path to do this. And certainly that will change our civilization at a very fundamental level. You can imagine that all of a sudden, if you can go to Jupiter for the weekend, your lifestyle is completely modified. And the way the world works is completely modified. And the idea that there's not enough space for everybody, the idea that there's not enough energy for everybody, the idea that there's not enough resources for everybody, that we have to war for them, all that goes away. So I'm extremely enthusiastic and positive in the outlook of our future. And we just have to make it through these very important little steps that we're making right now. And that's why we need the help of everybody out there. We need everything we have. We need all the juice we can get to bring the morphogenetic field to these important moments.
Great. Beautifully said. Okay, I'm going to run over just a quick list here of some of the things that, come to my mind that we're going to be seeing that I'm quite confident. All this is evidence-based. First, I think we're going to see a dramatic up-leveling of peaceful parenting, where parents stop spanking, beating, yelling at, or shaming their children. I think kids are going to be taught effective communication and conflict resolution in elementary school. I think we're going to see whole new education systems based on the fundamental pattern, not only as content, but as a delivery system through computer networks and so forth. I think if we don't have I think we're going to see a tax revolt if they're needed to ultimately move into individual freedom and beyond an authoritarian society. I think we're going to see a dramatic boost in telepathy amongst individuals. I totally agree about the anti-gravity and free energy. I think we're going to be, not too long, we're going to be looking at holographic TV, where we're going to actually be looking at three-dimensional shapes in our living rooms. And that there are going to be publicly available super effective cures for cancer and most, if not all, of the diseases that people are kind of taking for granted and assuming are intractable today. So I hope to be around for all of that, because I'm confident that all of that is coming in soon. So we're going to need to wrap it up, and I want to finish actually just really quickly by reading a poem that I found when I was going through in preparation for this event today, a birthday poem that I wrote to Nassim in 1999.
Oh my God.
And I read over it, and it's as pertinent today as it was then. So I want to finish with this. It's called A Visit, A Vision, and A Vector. When you were merely a young boy of 7, you were graced with a visit and a vision, and shown there's no wait for what's longed for in heaven, and you grew into a man with a mission. I know that you know it's a double-edged sword to see so much and so clearly so young, to know in your soul what we're all heading toward when it seems there's so much to be done. But you've opened your mind and your wallet and your heart to put form to what you know to be true. I admire your courage to finish what you start. And most of all, I deeply honor you. So thank you, Nassim. Happy birthday, and we will look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us. I'm so sorry we didn't have hours more to get to all the questions that have backed up, but that'll just fuel our conversations in the future.
Yeah, and remember to come on January 9th. I think we'll have another really fun opportunity for a conversation. And thank you so much, Nassim. It's a pleasure to see you, and also everybody on the call. We really appreciate
absolutely
your time on Saturday.
So go open it up
me.
So we can say sorry, go ahead, Nassim.
I was just saying thank you for having me, and it's always a pleasure to be in you guys' presence, and you know, let's do it, go forward and thrive.
All right, thank you. Okay, go, why don't you open up the microphone so we can just say goodbye to one another.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you, Nassim. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
All that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much love.
Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you.
information and vibes into the universe.
Thank you, everybody.
Barry, sorry we didn't get to your question.
And not that anybody was killed or anything.
Hey, go on. I think we better close it down now.
I can't keep saying it. I think, I don't know any.